Lily. Hi, everybody. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, they got married a lot in my generation. I know where that last name is, Bob Corwin, my husband. He sends his love and wishes that he could have come with me, but that was impossible. And you'd love him if you once met that guy. We've been married a long time, 17 years, and it gets better all the time. And that's the way it's supposed to be with marriages. I know that some of you people have heard me talk before, and I sort of think of it that you've come one more time to hear about the old covered wagon days of Alcoholics Anonymous. And actually, I was just thinking about this today for the first time in years. I remember the first time that I ever even came near any alcohol, any booze. We lived in a tiny little nothing town in Texas, Alfred, Texas. And Grandpa had a little grocery store. And I would walk down there and go in, and he'd make a big deal out of giving me the gumdrops for the little egg that my pullet would lay. A little egg wasn't big as it was going to get, but I would carry that little egg down there. And sometimes he would give me a half a dozen black gumdrops. And those were my favorite, the black ones. And then I would divide them with my brother. And I remember one day, though, I went down there, and he was grumpy. And in fact, he practically threw me out of this little grocery store, and I couldn't imagine what was the matter with Grandpa. And I didn't know until I was 21 years old that he was an alcoholic. I adored him. I worshipped him, and he died an alcoholic. But I didn't know that then. But this day when he got rid of me and I didn't understand it, I was crying, and I walked right across the street from the little store to the railroad tracks. And like little kids do, you walk along the tracks, you know, and you sort of try to walk on the rail. And after a while, I saw a bottle. And I sat down on the railroad tracks and I picked it up. And it was a whiskey bottle, that's what it was. But the strange part of it was that when I removed the cork and I smelled that bottle, I liked it better than the perfume that my mother or my aunts wore. I thought that was the best smell of anything I had ever smelled. And I sat there and smelled and sniffed that bottle for a long time and forgot about it. And I happened to think of it last week. It has nothing to do with my being an alcoholic, but I did enjoy having that bottle, took it home, treated it like a doll or something for a long time. Well, it was soon enough that I found booze. We moved out here to out to Los Angeles in 1921, and I was a little girl and went to school there, but I was a kind of an oddball. I know that now. I had long hair, almost down to my knees, and my dad wouldn't let me cut it, and I thought the kids laughed at me in school, and they probably did. And I just didn't feel like I belonged. I had this sense of not belonging. I didn't know how to mix with these city kids. They seemed alien to me, and I felt they didn't like me, and I didn't want to go to the school. And I went to high school for a couple of years, and I felt the same way. And when I was 15, I had my first drink, and I got drunk. I just drank the rest of the bottle. The kids handed me a bottle, and I just turned it up and drank it. I was anxious to find out what that stuff was, because Papa, my dad, was a very stern, strict man, and he would never let the boys walk home from school with me. And he told me that I wouldn't be allowed to leave the house and go and have a date with a fellow until I was 18. Well, I got married long before then, my first marriage, just to get away from Papa and be able to do some of the things that those girls there in Los Angeles were doing, like going to parties, playing post office. That was a mysterious word to me. I didn't know what it meant. I'd never heard of such a thing. But when I drank, I passed out, and they carried me home and put me in Mama's bed. And, oh, to wake up and have to face them the next morning was the ultimate disgrace, because they were very stern, strict parents. And there's no doubt about that. And I begged for forgiveness, and I said, I don't know how it happened. It will never happen again. Please forgive me. Well, it was worse than murder or anything in my eyes. I had done the unforgivable thing. And they said, that's all right, little girl, forget it. It won't happen again. Well, it did. That week I went to a party, and I got drunk again. I didn't know the meaning of just having a drink or two drinks from the word go. And naturally, we know it progressed as the years went by. But I was 21 years old before I found out that my brother Tex was an alcoholic, or rather, he was a drunk. We had neither one of us heard the word alcoholic. And he was a terrible boozer, and he spent a lot of time trying to make me quit drinking. And I would tell him to mind his own business, because after all, he was bootlegging down on Skid Row in Los Angeles, and he was in jail a lot, and I would bail him out, and it was all because of booze. And I had bailed him out of jail 89 times. He was the drunk. I was not, and we argued about that a lot. Didn't get us anywhere because we continued to drink together and be together and almost came into Alcoholics Anonymous at the same time. He came in 2 or 3 weeks after I did. But we were very, very close. And those years of drinking were just so horrible. I had a little girl. I was unable to take care of her because of my drinking, so Mama had the baby. And my great desire at that time, I knew no better, was to sober up for the baby. I didn't think of me. Getting sober for me was not a thought. I didn't care if I died. I just didn't care if I lived or if I died. I was a legal secretary. I was a sales lady. I sold real estate. I worked in a taxi dance hall. I was a bootlegger. I could just go on and list the good jobs and the bad jobs that I had during those drinking years, because whatever Tex did, I did it with him. Now, if it was bootlegging, I was bootlegging with Tex. When I was in the real estate business, he came in the business with me, and we were inseparable. So it follows, I suppose, that when my drinking got intolerable and I picked up that Saturday Evening Post in March of 1941, and on the cover it said Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander, that marvelous pamphlet that you have now was taken from that very article that I read in this Turkish bath. And it jolted me because I had been trying secretly to quit drinking for years and had never had any luck. And I was fascinated by this article. I wasn't well enough to really read it, but I had heard of it in 1939 in the Liberty magazine. It just had a little brief message in the Liberty magazine saying, oh, something like this. There's a band of men in New York City who are banding together for the purpose of mutual sobriety. It was one paragraph, I think. And that impressed me. So now I'm so terribly hungover I can't go home, and I'm sobering up in this Turkish bath, and I pick up the Saturday Evening Post, and right there on the cover, it said Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a cure. I thought it was a place to go, and they would cure you, and then you'd leave. That's all. But that was fine with me, just fine. And so I asked for a pen and a pencil, or rather some paper to write with there in that Turkish bath. And for the first time in my life, I got a letter written, stamped, addressed, and mailed it all in the same day, which was a miracle. I mean, I don't do those things. And it was kind of a pitiful letter, I suppose. I turned to the end of the article. I saw these pictures, which had intrigued me. In the Saturday Evening Post, they had a picture of a man being placed in an ambulance on a stretcher. And I thought, oh, he's worse than I am, you know. He's terribly sick. And then I turned the page, and there was a picture of the man in a hospital bed, and two men were sitting there talking to him. It might have been Bill and Dr. Bob, I don't know. And I thought, oh, that's an AA hospital. I've got to go there and get cured. So in my letter to New York, writing to that box number of AA in New York, I said, I will take the next plane back to your AA hospital to get cured. I am a desperate woman alcoholic. Please help me. Well, Bill's secretary, Ruth Hawk, wrote me a letter, and it came within a week or 10 days. Probably my letter was an early wave, got there in an early wave of mail, because Ruth has since told me that she had to deal with thousands upon thousands of letters from the Saturday Evening Post. And obviously, my letter must have been among the first she received, because I got a very prompt answer. And it said, in general, you don't have to come back to New York to find Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have gone. Because you have a group in California. And fortunately for you, it is in your own hometown, Los Angeles. But I must tell you, my dear, they have never had any luck with Lady Lushes. And she said, we've had our problems, too. But she says we have one now, and her name is Marty, and she's been sober 9 months. Well, to me, that was the same as if she'd have said 90 years. I remember so well when I came in how impressed I was with the members that we had. I would say, how long have you been sober? And Cliff Walker, my sponsor, would say 4 months. And Frank Randall, the leader of the group, Frank had been sober 8 months. Well, that was terribly impressive. It was. I had never dreamed of anything like that. They couldn't have impressed me more. And Mort Joseph had been sober almost a year. But I'm getting ahead of myself because here I am now, desperate, wanting help, and seeing this magazine and writing the letter, and they told me there was a group in California. They said, go on down. You will be very welcome. And so I thought I would. But my non-alcoholic husband, who was on the verge of divorcing me, he'd put up with an awful lot. We'd been married 13 years, and he had adopted my little baby from a previous marriage. And he was a good father to her, and he was a good husband to me, but he was getting ready to divorce me. And I knew it. And I didn't want that to happen. I wanted to get sober more than anything in the world. And so when I told him about this letter from New York, from the home office, why, he said, I'll drive you down. Well, it's a good thing that he said that, because I was shaking so badly, and I was so hungover that I couldn't even comb my hair, and I had it all rolled up under a bandana-type red thing, just kind of in scarf and tucked under like that to get rid of all the hair so they couldn't see it. My eyes were bloodshot, my face was swollen and puffy, and I was shaking, and I would dig my palms, my fingernails, into the palms of my hand, and they were just little half moons of healed, half healed sores there where I was just gripping just as hard as I could to hang on. And he drove me down to the mother group. Well, I remember it was a terribly stormy night, and the water was all over the streets, and you could hardly drive, and it was quite an undertaking. But we went to the Elks Temple, where Ruth Hawk had told us to go. And we went in there, and they met in a dining room. The Elks Temple is a huge place, and they just met in a small room around a table, such as we have here, possibly two tables the size of that, because there were about 10 or 12 men, and my husband and myself. And I was so ashamed. I didn't see any women. And I sat there with my head down, and I thought they were doctors or something, and they would discuss my case and tell me what to do. I had no idea in the world what would happen to me. And I was frightened, and I was just petrified. And so the leader stood up, Mort Joseph, and he said, this is the regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of men who have banded together for the mutual purpose of staying sober on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. They said that a long time before the day-at-a-time thing came along. And they'd say that at every meeting. Well, that was pretty grim to me. You know, I thought to myself, what an order. I can't go through with that. And after I'd heard those terrible words, lifetime basis without an eyedropper full of booze, no way. Then he added, but as is our custom, before the regular meeting starts, we'll have to ask the women to wait outside. What women? I looked around. I hadn't seen any. It turned out that there were a couple of wives that had come, but having come before, they knew exactly what to do, and that was to stay out in the lobby with their knitting and talk about their husbands or whatever women did before Al-Anon, and they were already out there. And so I stood up and put my hands over my face, and I was crying, and I went out in the lobby, and I lurked around and went in the powder room, and I lurked around more, and they stayed in there for, it seemed to me, like hours. It was the only meeting in California, and they had come from a great distance. There was a fellow there from Santa Barbara and one from Hanford, California, Kent Hayden from San Bernardino, and Mel Trickey from Orange County, and then there was Frank and Mort, the leaders of that group. In those days, the leaders kept the group until they were thrown out. I mean, there was no other way. They didn't have elections or anything. They were the leaders. Every Friday night, they talked, and we listened. Nobody got to participate, just Frank and Mort, Frank and Mort. And I loved it. If that had been all there was to it, I would have still been sitting there listening to Frank and Mort and Frank and Mort. But it was quite an experience because there I sat out in the lobby and my poor husband in there finally staggered out when the meeting was over and he said, "My God, Sib, you don't know what I've been through." He'd never had a short beer in his life and they thought they had a newcomer and they had really all been directing their remarks. He said, "They looked at me, every last one of them. Every time anyone would speak, they'd look at me." And he said, "What for? I don't understand." He said, "All they did was brag." He said, "I never heard such a bunch of braggers in my life. One of them would say, 'Well, I drank 2 quarts a day for 40 years. And another one would say, 'Well, I drank 3/5 a day for 20 years. And so on. And he said, "It was a you top this kind of conversation, which I don't understand at all." He said, "Gee, I don't know what you're getting into, Sib." He says, "I'm going to take you home." Well, I burst into tears and I had hysterics. And I tell you, when I got home, I jumped out of that car and I went to the nearest bar. And there I told everybody on either side of me, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And they'd say, "So what?" They'd never heard of it. And I didn't know what it was. And I hadn't been allowed to stay in the meeting and my heart was broken. That's all I knew. And I just wanted to drink myself to death and I darn near did. And then finally when the bartender threw me out, which wasn't the first time, I was on the sidewalk out in front of the place and I saw this pay telephone. And then I remembered I had taken a letter of authorization from New York, the one that was signed by Ruth Hawk that told me to go down to that meeting. I thought it was a letter of authorization that I would have to hand those people downtown and then they would accept me or reject me or whatever because it was a letter from New York. And I remembered that letter. And so I looked at it again, and sure enough, down at the bottom, it said, "P.S., if you need help, call Cliff Walker." Well, I thought, I sure need help. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I put a nickel in the telephone, and I was very drunk. And fortunately, Cliff was just leaving to pull his milk route. He was a milkman at that time. And my first words to him was, "Send your AA ambulance and pick me up." It made sense to me. I thought that's what they did on account of the Saturday Evening Post. And he said, "Well, you're drunk." I said, "Well, of course I am. I went down to your exclusive club tonight, and they threw me out. And so what am I supposed to do? I drink. I'm drunk. Of course I'm drunk." He said, "Wait a minute. You said they threw you out. There's a mistake somewhere." He said, "Did you tell them that you were an alcoholic?" I said, "Of course not." Well, he said, "You should have told them because we need you." And I thought that went over for a minute. And I said, "Well, I don't know what to do. What'll I do?" And he said, "Go back and tell them you're a woman alcoholic." He said, "We do need you because there are going to be other women coming in and we need you to go see them, bring them to the meetings and all that stuff. But I got to go to work now." I said, "You mean to tell me you're not going to come and get me? I can't even drive. I'm drunk." He said, "No, I can't do that. You have to get home the best way you can." I said, "Young man, I've had enough of this. I have a letter of authorization from New York, which should have entitled me to every consideration down at your meeting tonight, and I had none there. And now you're not giving me any consideration, and I'm going home all right. But I'm only going home for one reason. In the morning, I'm going to phone the New York office, and I'm going to have you fired." Well, it turned out that Cliff was my sponsor. We lost Cliff just 2 years ago on my birthday, March the 23rd. Last March 23rd, I was sober 41 years. But my God, it seems like yesterday. Because I'll quote from my husband, who's a member of AA. He said he's been having a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's continuing. And he says love affairs ought to get better. Couples know that, married people know that, and he said it's true with AA, it gets better all the time. And if that could be instilled into all the new people, or nearly new people who are here tonight, that it really does get better all the time, or I wouldn't be here. And a lot of other people in this room that have been sober long periods of time, don't let that scare you. We know that we're alcoholic. We know that if we should drink now, we would die. We know that. It's a killer. I don't want to die. My God, I'm 74 years old. I intend to be here. I'm going to come right back to Grants Pass when I'm 99 and make another talk. Well, it's unbelievable to think that I went back down to that meeting And Frank Randall, oh, I was afraid of him. He was so handsome and so well-dressed and everything, and he had this marvelous, eloquent, booming voice. He went off the podium and came back with a big carton box full of letters. And he said, "Now hear this. If any of you jokers have been sober over 15 minutes, get up here and get these 12-step calls. They all came in from that Saturday Evening Post article. We need every one of you. I don't care if this is your first meeting. As long as you're sober, come up here and get them, because I got about 30 or 40 calls for each one of you." And he'd say, "Is there anybody living in Long Beach?" He had them tied up in little bundles. And Curly O'Neill raised his hand and said, "Here." And he went down and he got his. "Anybody from San Bernardino?" Same thing happened. Kent Hayden said, "Here." And he got his. And then the beaches were covered. And Orange County was covered. And the local boys, south of Slauson, north of Slauson, Pasadena, and Glendale, you name it. And he got down to the last bundle of letters. And he said, "I've saved these to the last." There were about 40 or 50 of them. "I've saved these to the last because we have a woman alcoholic now in our group. Our first woman alcoholic, and her name is Sybil. So come on up here, Sybil. I'm going to put you in charge of all the women." And I felt so pleased. I thought, I was kicked out last week, and now I'm in charge. So I tottered up there the best way I could. And I looked up at him. I had to go up there because he was that kind of a fellow. "Come on up here, Sybil." So I got up. I don't remember how I got up there, but I looked up at this very tall man. And I said, "I can't, sir." And he says, "Why not?" I said, "Because I'll be drunk next Friday. I can't bring those women down here. I've never been sober that long. Unless there's something going to happen here tonight. You haven't gotten around to telling me what to do or what not to do or what's going to happen to where I can stay sober a week until the next meeting. I've never done that. And so I wouldn't want to. You say somebody could die if these calls weren't made, if I didn't go to see those women, and I can't take that responsibility because I've never been sober that long, and if I didn't make those calls, maybe one of those women would die. Unless you can tell me something here tonight before I leave that will make it possible to know that I can stay sober and do that." And he said, "Well, I can tell you, yeah, but it won't be me telling you. It's just in this book that we go by." He says, "This is what started AA here in California, just a book and a couple of fellows. But it says right here on page so-and-so, and Bill, who is our founder, said, 'When all other measures fail, working with another alcoholic will save the day.'" He says, "That's what will keep you sober. Get your mind off yourself. Answer those calls. Read those letters. And when you park in front of the house with a letter, take the letter in your hand that gal wrote. Ring the doorbell. When she comes to the door, you say to her, 'My name is Sybil, and I'm an alcoholic, and I've been to a meeting of AA. Now, do you have a drinking problem?' And when she says, 'Well, yes, that's my letter I wrote for help,' say, 'Well, then come with me. I don't know anything about it yet, but come with me and we'll find out about it together.'" He says, "That's all. That's all. Don't add anything to it because you don't know anything about it yet." He said, "Just go get them and bring them here." So I said, "Well, I guess I can do that." So I took this big stack of letters home and read them. And out of curiosity, when my brother Tex came over that day, he read some of those letters. And he said, "Well, I tell you, Sib, I don't know what this is, but I think it's a get-rich-quick scheme they're pulling on you. I better go down and look it over." At that time, he was a peddler down on Skid Row. He was a man of great talent who had had a coffee company and a milk company, a dairy, the Lone Star Rancho, because we came from Texas. And now he is peddling vegetables from Produce Row and has a bunch of winos working for him. And he says, "Well, the least it could do, if it could sober up those winos for me, they could get in a day's work for me. So maybe I better go down and look them over." Well, I didn't know that he was admitting. I wanted Tex to stay away. This was for me. Everything that we had done together had failed. Of course, I didn't realize I was risking his life, but I begged him, "No, Tex, please don't go." Well, that was all that I had to say. You tell a drunk to go north, and he'll go south every time. "Well, I'm going. I'm going. You can't keep me from going." I said, "Don't you go down there with booze on your breath. or we'll both get thrown out and I'll lose my chance. No, I'll be sober, he said. So the following Friday night, he pulled up in front of my house in his vegetable truck, and standing up in the back were 11 winos. And here we all go down to the mother group, and there were more of us than there were of them. And then is when I got to hear marvelous Frank Randall talk and Mort Joseph talk. Now, I wasn't listening. I was looking around at the people. And I didn't really hear this fifth chapter. I wonder if a hungover, sick, drunk hears the fifth chapter. The people was about all that my mind could hold right then. It was just the people. And I knew they had a program and they talked about it. But I couldn't concentrate on that. But when Frank said, now, we have got to get these 12-step calls made by next Friday, and he called me up there and said, here, take these letters and go see those women, and all you have to do is just say, come with me. I've been to a meeting. Well, I said, I can do that, and I went home with that mail, and I started making those 12-step calls, and believe me, that women's group got up to about 40 in about a month, and I was still in charge, and the goose hung high, and I felt pretty proud of my little job of being in charge, which didn't amount to a row of beans, but to me it did, because they would call me if they had a problem, and I was on the phone continually and constantly, and what it was doing, it was keeping me sober, and my brother Tex was staying sober, but then all of a sudden, the roof caved in, because Tex got tired of sitting there listening to Frank and Mort, and he started the hole in the ground in Huntington Park. Well, the elders down at the mother group excommunicated him. Now, I should have said first that we had no traditions. That's why he was excommunicated. He was the first one to be excommunicated. We did terrible things in those days. We were making the traditions, which came along later, through these horrible mistakes that we made then. Because they came up to him and they said, Tex, you have no loyalty to the mother group. Here you got your sobriety right here in this room with us, and you have the nerve to rent a hall and start a meeting in competition with us. No, Tex said, that's not so. He said, I've been going down to Long Beach to their little home meeting, which was all Long Beach had at that time. I've been coming faithfully here on Fridays and Wednesdays down to Long Beach. And he said, I think that a meeting halfway in between in Huntington Park or Southgate would be just fine. It shouldn't interfere with you. I'm going to go ahead and start this group. And they said, well, we don't want you down here anymore, so don't come down again. And he said, well, I'll be pretty busy and I won't have much time, but let's get this clear. That any time I want to come down here, I'm going to come down here. And nobody can throw me out. And so they backed off at that. But we did try to throw out quite a few people there. If they had two slips, Lee Fowler had two slips. And we gathered together in a little huddle, and me right along with him. And we said, he's a phony baloney, and he's had two slips. And so the next time he gets drunk, that's it, that's it. And he said, that's right, that's right. And so when Lee got drunk again, we marched over to him. And Harry Chisholm came up to us. He was our first member from Pasadena. And he said, look, folks, let's not start this business of making rules for people. Lee's a good boy. He might sober up and be one of our best members. We can't do that. We can't throw anybody out. Let's get that down and remember it from now on. And we didn't throw Lee out nor anybody else out after that. But I was still in charge of the women, and I loved every minute of it. But all of a sudden, one night, I'm at the mother group, which had about 300 people by that time. And coming down the aisle towards me was a girl that I had made a call on a few months before that. Her name was Kay. And trailing in back of her were six strangers, six women that had not been cleared through me. And the minute I saw that, I walked right back to her. And I said, Kay, where did you get these women? They haven't been cleared through me. She said, that's right, Sybil. I live in Culver City, and so do they. And I used to drink with them, and they saw me sober for a while. And they have a problem, and they wanted to come to this meeting, and I told them that I'd be happy to bring them, and that's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be, and I'm never, never going to take any orders from you again, Sybil. So I got tears in my eyes, and I said, oh, and I backed off real quick, and I went out to the hole in the ground. I told my brother this terrible treatment that Kay had given me. He said, honey, the handwriting is on the wall. If you're smart, You'll go down there next Friday and tell those women to elect a secretary that you're so busy helping your big brother with a hole in the ground that you no longer have time to do the job justice. And if you don't do that, honey, they're going to throw you out. And so I did that, and of course I cried a lot and got over that. And life was good, and it was exciting, and we made a lot of 12-step calls, and we took a lot of people to meetings. But, you know, I think that the impetus of the excitement of the whole thing, to me, the word Alcoholics Anonymous itself was a privileged word. I would walk down the street where I lived, and I'd look at the homes as I passed them on to go to the corner grocery store. And I'd look at these homes that I passed, and I'd think, they don't know it, but I'm anonymous. And it was a big thing with me. I was a member of an anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, for us, and that we belonged together, and that we could do it together. And none of us had been able to do it before, and we were all staying sober. And the group was growing, and I was changing just a little bit. But I was so terribly nervous that I could not stand up and participate. I thought I would die one night at the Friday meeting, which was huge. And Frank, wanting to be nice, said, we have a woman here who's doing a good job and making 12-step calls on the women. And I don't remember how long she's been sober. Sybil, will you stand up and tell us how long you've been sober? And I stood up, and with every bit of possession that I possibly could get at that moment, self-possession, I stood up, and it was the most horrible moment of my life. I stood up shaking, and I said, I've been sober 4 months. It was terrible for me. And I couldn't talk. Tech started the hole in the ground. It was a participation meeting, and everybody had to talk 3 minutes. Well, that was a long time to talk, 3 minutes. I couldn't. You don't know how much you can say in 3 minutes. Gee, there's George Swanson, who used to live down there. He can remember when it was a horrible ordeal for me to stand up and do 10 minutes. That's a long time, too. But participation, they insisted that because I was so frightened, they told me that I would get over it. That the same people, the thing was, and Tex told me this, too. He said, Sib, when we go to the hole in the ground, you and I will always get there by 7 o'clock and make the coffee. And then one person will come in, and we know him. His name is Joe. We'll say, hi, Joe. And then Susie will come in. Hi, Susie. There's 4 of us now. And then pretty soon there'll be 6 of us, and then 8 and 10 and 12 and so on. We get there an hour and a half early, and we talk to these people that long. We sit down and open the meeting, and we just continue to do what we've been doing for the last hour and a half. He said, it's that simple, so I'm going to call on you next Friday night. And he did. It was awful, but I did it. Oh, I was so proud. I may have given him a weather report. I have no idea what I said. But when I sat down, that crowd of 20, 25 people knowing me and knowing how frightened I had been and was, they began to applaud. And I thought it was, that applause sounded like it would have sounded in the Coliseum. They applauded me for the effort that I made, and I grinned to myself there at that little group at the hole in the ground. And I thought, my God, was I really that good? And I thought, I got to get down there to that mother group on a Friday night and really show them how I can talk. Well, I didn't do much talking for a good number of years. I would make my little short talks there at the hole in the ground. But I went to work in the Los Angeles Central Office, and I was there for 12 years. And that was part of the responsibility that I had, was to get the groups acquainted who was downtown at the office. And it was a marvelous era in my life to have the members walk in and talk to us and buy their literature and books and ask for speakers and take care of the new people who called up and get them sponsors and so on. And honest to goodness, those sick drunks, those real sick drunks who called up or came in never gave us a problem of any kind. The sober members sometimes did, but that was all there was to it. And it was a glorious experience, but very, very hard to do. And after 12 years, I can say that 10 or 12 years in a service office is more than enough. And you go on to something else. The thing is that I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's so many phases of it. I mean, first you come in, and all you're thinking about is, am I going to drink? Can I stay sober like that guy? Can I stay sober like my sponsor? And of course you can. And then after a while, somebody will say, will you be treasurer of the group or secretary of the group? And so you do that. And then you go to service meetings, and you go to committee meetings, and you go to participation meetings and speaker meetings and even conventions. And there's no end to the different facets of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, of course, the most important thing today, as it was then, is going to call on a newcomer and taking them to the meeting. I think sponsorship is terribly important. I was sponsored by Frank Randall for a long time and by my brother for a long time. And it seems to me that sponsorship is a marvelous thing. I like to work with alcoholics. Bob had a heart attack last July and couldn't go to meetings for a long, long time, so they brought the meeting to our home. And what a wonderful thing, from July up until possibly last November, every week, the living room was crowded with members from our group, and then we'd sit around the big dining room table, and we'd get out the big red book, and we would read the fifth chapter, and then we'd go around the table, and everybody would talk. And I don't think there's anything finer in the world than a home meeting. I like the little groups, and I like the big groups. Well, life has a way of dealing us out blows. When I came into AA, I thought that from now on, because I'm sober, nothing bad will ever happen. But that isn't the way it is, because life goes on and we'll get our jolts and we'll get our bad times. And I'm not going to dwell on that, but I will say that when my brother died right there at the hole in the ground in October of 1952, I didn't handle it at all well. I became a zombie. I felt cold as stone. I didn't suffer. I didn't grieve. I went to the meetings. Somehow or other, maybe I thought that the members ought to see me as the good example. I don't know what I was thinking. But it was a peculiar time that was terrible for me. I didn't react the way that you're supposed to react. Now these days, I cry buckets full of tears when I feel like crying. And for no good reason, maybe just a silly movie or something like that. It's easy for me to cry. But in that terrible time, I couldn't. And I got worried about myself, and the group was worried about me, and they knew that I wasn't behaving properly, going down there and leading the meeting sort of in defiance of the idea that Tex was no longer there and all that. And so finally, I couldn't talk to them about it, and I don't know why. I could today. I finally wrote a letter to Bill Wilson, and I knew him and had had the good fortune to get acquainted with him when he would come out to Los Angeles in the early days to see how AA was getting along, and had been back in New York and had visited with him there and at conventions and so forth. And I felt that I knew him well enough to, and Tex had visited him up in Bedford Hills, so I wrote this pitiful letter to him and told him exactly what I'm telling you now. And I said, what's going to happen to me, Bill? I don't think of drinking. I don't want to get drunk. But if I continue like this, I guess I'll die. Can you say to me that will snap me out of this so that I can go on with a job of living? And he sent me a letter, which I have been having mimeographed now for a good number of years and sending copies to people who have found the letter useful to them. It was the one paragraph in that letter that I remember, and the rest of it was lovely, but that's one paragraph. It said, the beginning of the letter said, it was talking about Tex, and he said, in God's house there are many mansions, and somehow or other I see your brother Tex sitting on the porch of one of those mansions talking to another drunk, and that's as it ought to be, and so much for Tex. But, now as for you, my dear, I'll tell you this, that life is but a long day in school. And some of our lessons are hard. And some of our lessons are easy. It's not so much what happens to us here, but it's what we do with the experiences that we have. It's the demonstration that counts. And I read that over and over, and finally, at last, I did cry. And it was good. And that very paragraph there comes to mind, every week, sometimes every day, always it's with me, that this is, life is a long day in school. And it pertains to us all in that light. And that none of us probably will just have all marvelous goody-goody two-shoes times, and that we can just go along and live and accept whatever life deals out to us and be stronger for it afterwards, I suppose, so that possibly we might meet someone in this great Alcoholics Anonymous that has had a similar experience, the same as our drinking experience. I don't know these things, but it seems to me that it might be that way. Well, anyway, working there in the central office, all these things happened, and some of them really stand out today. I'll never forget the time that I was walking my dogs in the park near the central office, and then I'd take them in the apartment two blocks away and put them inside for the day and go on down to the central office. And as I was walking my dogs that day, I saw a man under a tree, and as I walked by with the dogs, he wanted some sense of privacy. He picked up a newspaper and held it up over his face as I walked by, which attracted my attention, the poor guy, the wino who was sitting there unable to get up or get down or move or anything, and it attracted my attention. And so I took the dogs home and worked that day with a sort of a troubled mind, and that night I couldn't sleep, and I got up and I got in my car. Now, bad things weren't happening in those days like it is today, and I wasn't afraid, and I drove back down to that park, and I parked my car, and I walked under that tree, and he was lying there on the ground. He had not moved, you see. And I stood over him, and I said, Mister, and I forgot to tell you, on the way back down there to that tree to see if he was there, I stopped at the liquor store. It was about midnight or something like that, and I bought a little jug of wine, and I bought a can of tomato juice. And I took this in the little sack there, and I kept saying, Mister, and he didn't move. And I thought, he's dead. If I'd have done something today, maybe I could have saved his life. But finally, I saw a movement of some kind, and I laid this little sack on his chest. And I went back to the car, and I got a big sheet of paper, and I found a safety pin in the glove compartment, and I wrote, stay here, I'll be back at 6 o'clock. Don't leave. And I pinned it on his chest. And I came back the next morning, and there he was. And he said, little lady, I sure do thank you. When I got home last night, the tree was his home, see. When I got home last night, I guess I was pretty drunk, and I hung my glasses up in this tree here, so I can't see without them. So when I woke up this morning, I couldn't read your little note. So I took it down to the corner bar, and I gave it to the bartender, and he said, you get back there under that tree or wherever you were. This lady says she's coming back to see you. So he said, I hustled back here, and I've been waiting for you, so now what are you going to do with me? So I got him in the car and took him down to the men's 12-step house, and they took good care of him. And after a few weeks, he would come down to the central office and say hello. The 12-step house was only a few blocks away. And after a few weeks, he came in with a big smile on his face. They had discovered that he was stone deaf. And the manager of the 12-step house had a hearing aid that had been left there with somebody else, and they put it on his ear, and his face lit up. All that he'd been getting out of the meetings was just this, you know, just like that. But now he could hear, and now he was sober. And when he came in the office that day and said, I can hear the meetings. I can hear him read the fifth chapter and so on. It was a marvelous thing to see what happened to that man as the months went by. He didn't look the same. He didn't act the same. And this is what happens to us when we get a new person in AA. Those changes, it's just a miracle to see someone. You don't even recognize them sometimes. After they've been sober 6 months and they've straightened up and their hair is combed and they've got on a new pantsuit or dress or what have you. And we do change, not only in looks, but our lives change. And we become more dedicated to this program, and I believe we love it more all the time because more and more people are coming in, and I don't know when it will ever stop. In listening to Hugh when he was talking about Bill and Dr. Bob, I will treasure forever those times, those few fleeting hours that I had with Bill. And I only met Dr. Bob once, and I only met Marty Mann a couple of times. But to me, there was something very special about the little bit of time that I had with them. Imagine, as Hugh pointed out, how the wisdom of this book could come into being with a fellow who had never written a book before, and probably none of them that helped with it had ever written a book before. And the book is so beautiful, we all agree that we would make a big red book, which is not to be had anymore. And I do prize it above all of the possessions that I have. The only difference, of course, is the stories. The steps have never changed, and I'm sure that they never will. But the lack of the traditions in the early days made it almost fatal, because we would get more money than we needed in the group, and we'd spend it for some outlandish purpose. We didn't know about supporting the services. We didn't know anything about a central office. We didn't even have one. and we were just flying blind and going in all directions. A fellow named Charlie, and we called him the book because he was going blind, and knowing that he was going blind, he memorized the book. He truly did. And he could get up and just start on any chapter that you wanted to and make a beautiful talk, because all he had to do was recite the chapter. And he decided he wanted the hole in the ground, and Tex wouldn't give it up. And so it was a kind of a, not a big fist fight or anything, but Tex had his group, and the book wasn't going to get it, so he rented a hall catty-cornered across the street in a church and opened his own group. So we go to the hole in the ground when the book is having his first meeting over there, and there's about 30 of us as usual. When we got any more than that, Tex had said, get on out of here and start your own group. We want to keep this one small. Start one in Southgate. Start one in Compton. Start one in Englewood. We'll come over and visit you till you get started. We want to keep this thing down where we can call on everybody. So now Charlie has this one across the street, and we're sitting there wondering what Tex is going to do. All of a sudden he said, say, you know what I think would be a good thing? You know how we sponsor individuals when they're new, we do anything for them, we try to help them and everything. Well, a group is just like an individual. Now, the book has a new group, and tonight is his first meeting. And I think the thing for us to do is just to close this meeting, and all of you fellows get up now, and you gals, and we're going across the street and attend the book's group. He said, I think that would be a fine thing to do. Now, Charlie, he was mad at Tex, is the reason he started that group. But when he saw us all pour in on his first meeting, he stood up there and he looked for a minute or two, and then all of a sudden there was a big smile, and he laughed until he was sick, and all was well, because we found there was room for another group anywhere, anytime, where there was a need, and it didn't hurt anybody at all. And Charlie would come over to our group, he changed the night, and we would go over to his meeting, and pretty soon there were meetings all over the place, and there was a little rivalry. Well, of course, my being in charge of the women had to end. That is what hurt. Tex pointed it out to me. He said, honey, it's time for you to resign or they will fire you. And when I did that, I thought that I wouldn't be able to bear it very much longer, not being able to give out all those 12-step calls. But that was made up when I went to work in the central office, because the stories that come out of those service offices are truly marvelous stories of success of people who get sober and stay sober. I have so much faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that it will work for anyone. I don't think there are any helpless, hopeless alcoholics. I never have, because I have seen too many get sober after everyone is discouraged with them and saying, well, Susie can't make it, John can't make it, you know. And then all of a sudden, maybe you haven't been to a certain group for a long time, you haven't seen them, and you figure they're dead, and you go into a group, and there they are, and they're the secretary of the group. You just haven't seen them, and they've sobered up finally. And so it's a success story all the way. The young kids that come in, I sponsored a 13-year-old girl who was actually a little girl from the streets because her mother was a practicing alcoholic. And today she's an attorney in Los Angeles. It's unbelievable that she was able to get sober and stay sober sort of by herself, with living around in different AA homes. She was 6 feet tall. And when I first saw her at a meeting, I looked way up at her and I said, how old are you, honey? She said, I'm 13. And she was. And I thought, 13? Jiminy, criminy, 13. Well, then I thought about it. I was drunk and passed out at 15. And so she's been sober ever since. Everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous just fell in love with her. And she, you may have had her up here to speak for you. I don't know. She's 22 or 23 now. And she goes around and makes talks, all marvelous talks. And her mother is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you see these things happen. You see somebody that you will swear hasn't got a chance, and they make it. And I don't know anything about it. I don't know how it happens, but it's just that way. Usually it's members of our families that we'll think, he would never sober up. And they find it somewhere, and they tell you they're in AA, and you don't even know it sometimes for a few months. I know with me, I was afraid to tell my family about AA because I figured I was a failure. I thought if I go home and tell them, especially Papa, who was living with me when my mother died, and Papa, I had put him through a lot, an old man who didn't believe in having any liquor in the house, old man in his 70s. I didn't say a word. I would go to the meeting and I'd come home. I wouldn't tell him where I'd been. And I waited and waited. And I thought, maybe I'll screw up and I won't be able to make it. And what's the use in arousing any hope in this old man? But finally, I kept looking forward at first to 9 days, which was the longest I'd ever been sober. And then I made it 10 days. So then I thought maybe I could stay sober 30 days. Maybe. A long time ahead. It was unheard of. Absolutely unheard of. And then when it was 30 days, I went in the kitchen and I said, "Papa, I don't think I'm going to have to drink again. I've been sober a month." He says, "That's good, baby. You just keep it up." And it was a big day for me when I could report to him that I had been sober 30 days. I had a little bit of hope. The times would come during that period where my body had suffered so horribly for so many years that I would be so nervous that I would actually shake. I was absolutely powerless to talk to people at times, and I stuttered. I would walk up to you and start to talk, and I'd start stuttering and stammering. And I was so fearful. And I couldn't imagine that anybody would ever want to have anything to do with me or entrust me with anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, that was that big word, Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a member. I didn't want to violate anything in AA and get thrown out. I was so afraid they wouldn't want me or wouldn't keep me. And I kept that fear a long time. It was just too precious to think, now here is a way that I can stay sober. And then having my big brother there and having him start a group, it gave me a lot of hope that I could go along with him and stay sober. And maybe that had something to do with my sobriety. Who knows? I had a desire to not to drink. And sometimes it was rough. And particularly for the first 3 months, off and on, I wouldn't identify it as a craving exactly for alcohol, but things would get rough, and that bar was right across the street, and my real estate office was over here, and one day I rushed across there, and I went in that bar. Now, here's the difference between my being here tonight and being dead. I rushed in that bar. I know the reason now why I did it. I went in my driveway, and my car had been stolen. What? Where's my car? Where's my car? And I rushed across the street to Charlie's bar, and I run in there. I've been sober 30 days, and I said, "Charlie, give me a Coke." He said, "What the hell's the matter with you? You don't drink Cokes." I said, "Well, I do now." I just changed it there at the very end of that sentence. I said, "Charlie, give me a Coke." And he put the Coke down, and I drank it and put a nickel in the telephone and called the cops and told them my car had been stolen. And I simmered down, and I went to a meeting, and that was the closest I ever came. I never had to do that again. I really never did. And then I would think about it. What will happen, though, when these beautiful times are gone? And what if any trouble strikes where a person just naturally would get drunk? What'll I do then? Well, as I say, those things just eventually happen. I bought a boxing and wrestling arena with my brother Tex. And I put all my money in it. He'd been a former wrestler. And we made a lot of money for a couple of years. And then we lost it. And we lost it all because TV came in. And everybody stayed home glued watching the boxing and wrestling on TV. And nobody came to this big arena. And finally, when I locked it up and walked away from it and had them tear the building down, and I got a few dollars out of that and had to go through bankruptcy, I thought, my God, can it get any rougher than this? Oh, yeah, it could. It could. I just went back to work as a secretary in an office for $175 a month. That's what they were paying there in 1951 or 1952. And I picked away at the typewriter and made a little money and was pretty soon was just as happy as if I had a lot of money. Started all over again. And I found out that money has nothing to do with anything. You either have some or none or a lot or a little, and it has nothing to do with happiness. Because I found some of the happiest times of my life after I lost that arena, but I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea that other things were in store for me. I had no idea they'd call me up one night and say, "Sybil, would you like to be the executive secretary at the central office of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I took that big, really big. Nobody to train me because the former secretary had died of a heart attack and the former secretary before that had died of a heart attack. That job kills them. I mean, there were no survivors, really. After years, that's what happens to you in that office. And so I went down there, nobody to train me or tell me anything. And I opened that door on January the 2nd of 1955 and the phones were ringing. Three phones ringing, just ringing, ringing, ringing. And I went over there, "Alcoholics Anonymous, can I help you?" "Yes, I need help. Can you send somebody to see me?" "Yeah, what's your name?" And I just took the name and the address and then looked in the file there and found the names of some AAs and, you know, sent them over to Mecca 12-step college. Just kind of blindly went along like that and put the money in the bank and did the bookkeeping and did the meeting directory and took the minutes of the Central Service Committee. And the drunks that walked in, they were just, I just loved to see them come in and see them get some help. And those were wonderful years. But I didn't know until I resigned from there, when Bob and I were married in 1966, that I was that exhausted. I fell apart for almost 2 years. It was very, very trying, because occasionally you're going to hear from a customer who will really say some naughty things, and you have to keep your temper. And I was taught never to rough up a drunk, or especially a drunk, and be nice at all times from the central office of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I had to be. And I wouldn't trade those years for anything in the world. And then Bob and I re-met. Now, Bob had been a neighbor of mine out there at the hole in the ground. And everybody loved Bob, but Bob wouldn't stay sober. He has a personality that you will never forget. He is a charmer. And I was charmed by him. He was a neighbor of mine. I loved his wife. And so my husband, Jim Willis, who is the founder of Gamblers Anonymous, we became a foursome. And we went everywhere together. We went to conventions and everywhere. But Bob went back to drinking because he was an atheist. And I mean a real hardcore atheist that used to stand down there at the hole in the ground and argue with people about there was no God. So he didn't stay sober. But we would grieve over Bob, and he would come back and he'd give it another whirl because he loved the people. He loved the meetings. He just didn't believe in God. And so he would get drunk. Well, in 1963, my husband, who had started Gamblers Anonymous in 1957, left me for a beautiful 25-year-old blonde, and I thought my world was over. I was going to die. I couldn't live with that. I loved him dearly. I couldn't stand it. And through the door walked Bob Corbin, good neighbor Bob from the hole in the ground, and his wife had kicked him out. And I said, oh, Helen can't do that to you, Bob. I'll call her up and fix everything up for you. And I called her up, and I said, Bob is back in AA. He's going to be all right. She said, don't tell me that. You get him sober for a year, and I might consider it. Well, the upshot of that was, when he was sober about 4 years, I married him. And I never dreamed that anything like this would happen. Because Jim, the founder of Gamblers Anonymous, evidently found that 25-year-old blonde, that was the cute thing to do, and that didn't last over a month or two, but never mind that. Bob and I became buddies all over again. We went to thousands of meetings together. We went every night his first year of sobriety. And he came to believe. He came to believe. Now, I knew that man from way back there when he would argue with you. But he went to the North Hollywood group one night. And, I was with him because I was with him every night. I couldn't hardly stand it without having someone to cry, someone's shoulder to cry on. And this girl, at the conclusion of that meeting in North Hollywood, said something. Now, I think this is important. He kept going to meetings, and he wanted to stay sober, but he was reaching a point where he would have probably twisted off and gotten drunk again. But here is what she said. She said that the closest that you or I or anybody else will ever come to finding God will be in the seeking. And Bob put his head down, and I saw his shirt get wet. I saw his face wringing wet. And this girl had sort of broken down at the podium and had lost her train of thought for a minute or two, and we were all just sitting there pulling for her, and Bob, too, to see anyone in that shape making a talk. And her very next words were what I just told you. The closest that you or I or anybody will come to finding God will be in the seeking. Well, the meeting was over, and I went out in the coffee room, and Ellen, the girl who said that, was crying. And she said, Sib, I screwed it up so bad tonight. I stopped there for a long time, and I didn't help anybody. I just didn't help anybody at all. I said, you come with me. And we went back in the auditorium. The others had all gone home. And there sat Bob, still glued to his chair. And he thought to himself, well, I've been in AA a long time, and I've had this attitude. There was nothing, you know, except the group and the people in it. But the closest I would ever come to finding God would be in the seeking. I guess maybe that's what I've been doing, because I've been coming back and back and back. And the closest I'll ever come is just to seek, and I can do that. And he was sitting there thinking all that, and he's never had another drink. It was just that one sentence that girl said that saved his life. It made sense. Just seek. Just look. Just have an open mind. Want to get sober. Listen to what the people say. You might not agree with everything the first time, second time, or even the third time, but you'll hear something good. And if you go to enough meetings, somebody's going to say that magic thing that happened to Bob that night that made it possible for him to get sober and stay sober and be the happiest member of AA you ever saw. And you see, I was there to witness all that because I'd seen him down at the hole in the ground when he couldn't stay sober over 2 weeks, maybe a month, maybe 3 months, just having good times in AA and not doing anything about the book or the steps or the program. And so that's the way it works. All of us come in with an equal chance if we realize that we've got this disease of alcoholism. It's too bad that those who have it and don't know it aren't here tonight. They don't know it yet, but they will. But they've got a place to come to, and it's so much easier now than it used to be. Now then, these young kids come in from grammar school and high school and college just as easy as if they had a case of the measles, you know, and they figure that such and such a thing will cure the measles. Well, they come in unabashed, unafraid, not ashamed, and they come to Alcoholics Anonymous because it's highly thought of. And they're not ashamed to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, where when I came in, you kind of kept it quiet. I wasn't going to tell the women next door with whom I had never been able to associate or with or play bridge with or trade recipes with because I was always hungover or gone drunk. I had no neighbors. I couldn't be a neighbor. I couldn't have any friends at all because I was so busy going out at night, getting drunk, staying in bed all the next day. And so it was that I just didn't have any friends. But now we have friends and we have people that in our own families are people that we know that when they get ready and they realize that they're alcoholic and all the favorable press that we've had now for so many years, we get good write-ups in the papers. Alcoholics Anonymous is known to be a fine organization. I don't think many people are ashamed to approach us anymore and say, I'm an alcoholic. Look, I need help. I can't control this thing. I'm in a lot of trouble and I've been for a long time. I want to join you. Fine. Come on in. The water's fine. I'm so happy to be here. You're such great people. The minute I drove into town today, I began to feel at home. And as the evening wore on, I feel more at home. And the best is yet to come, because I'm through now, and we get the rest of this convention. I can relax, get a good night's sleep, and come back here tomorrow and take the whole thing in. And I need it. I love it. I need it. And I need you. So I'm going to keep coming back. Thank you very much.